You're listening to Out There Atlanta, a podcast featuring interviews with artists in Atlanta and beyond, conducted in the spirit of a casual conversation. Out There Atlanta is sponsored by burnaway.org, an online destination for dialogue about the arts. Music for this podcast was provided by MSIF. For the next few months, Out There Atlanta brings you our Summer Sound series, which features interviews with artists who find inspiration in sound or directly use it in their works. Our first interview is with Philip March Jones, who's the director of Atlanta's Soils Grown Deep Foundation and also founded a nonprofit gallery called Institute 193 in Lexington, Kentucky. Institute 193 just released their first album, 193 Sound, which features recordings by musicians who have performed or will perform in the space. All the music in this podcast comes from 193 Sound. Here's Philip.
So my name is Philip March Jones, and I'm the director of the Soils Grown Deep Foundation here in Atlanta, Georgia, and the editor-in-chief, as it were, at Institute 193 in Lexington, Kentucky, which is a nonprofit contemporary art space that I started about 3.5 years ago.
Nice. Well, this is a great one to start off the Out There Atlanta Summer Sound series with, because Institute 193 just came out with their first album, and one of the songs on it is actually the Out There Atlanta theme song by Mike Stasny's side project MSIF, so I thought, what better way to kick this off? So, you know, I'd love for you to tell the listeners about this project and about the performances along the years that have led up to this.
Sure. Well, Institute 193 started as a pure sort of visual art space with the idea of documenting the cultural production of the South in books and exhibitions and traveling them around and helping artists find opportunities really to show their work. But immediately we started getting requests from musicians, particularly in the Lexington area, to perform at the space in conjunction with exhibitions or on their own. So from the very beginning, probably I think at the start of the second show, we had our first concert, which was Morgan O'Kane, who's a banjo player and singer originally from West Virginia, but who sort of travels around all the time now. And they played in conjunction with Bruce Burris's show, which was about mountaintop removal and everything, all the sort of political issues of Eastern Kentucky. So it really made sense for them to play in the same space. And then later Ben Solee played there with Cheyenne Mize, a fiddler from Kentucky. Ben Solee, of course, plays cello and sings. And then from there it just grew. We had people that were noise musicians, people that were pure sort of rock and roll, experimental, folk, really all across the board. And I'm not really sure that from the beginning, I am sure that we didn't really have an idea of producing any kind of long-term documentation of that process. But after 20 or 25 concerts or so, it became clear that music was becoming more and more a part of the program, and that it would be smart to find a way to package that so we could share it with the rest of the world. So
when did you found Institute 193?
Well, it started in 2009. I guess we started working on the project early in 2009 and opened our first show in October of that year. And it's been going well ever since. It's growing slowly but steadily. And in the music, and our engagement with the music community has really been great. For example, the current show, which is Lonnie Holly, is his visual work, particularly sculpture, and works on paper. But he also did a series of educational workshops and a concert, a musical performance at the gallery. So, and there are a lot of artists that are both musicians and visual artists. I think we've probably shown at this point 3 or 4 that sort of fit that bill, and most of them are on the CD.
Were you guys documenting the performances from the start, or was that something you realized was probably necessary later on?
No, we always were. I mean, sort of informally, I think, from the beginning. And the record is not live performances. I think some people think it's that it's
going to be literally the sounds of Institute 193.
Exactly. And we have recorded some of the shows, but the reality is the shows are really cramped. I mean, our gallery is about 400 square feet. So, we get 30 to 60 people depending on the show, and it can be kind of crazy. So so the album is made up of 25 tracks that are all recorded by artists that have performed or will be performing shortly at Institute 193.
As the water.
you've already mentioned that a lot of the artists that show within Studio 193 do have a musical background, but even when that isn't the case, do you find it to be sort of a natural fit, whatever the show happens to be with the music that's being performed?
I think so. I think there's always an interesting thing that happens in the space whenever somebody introduces that kind of element. Even tonight, for example, we have the Smacks, which is a group that J. Todd Dockery and Brian Manley started years ago. And J. Todd's an artist that we've shown at the gallery for his comic books and actual books that he's made. But in this context, he'll be performing with the Smacks, with Lonnie Holly's artwork in the background. And I think you find points of connectivity, or, you know, sort of this funny thing happens, cross-pollination. But, you know, I don't think it always has to be very specific either. I mean, again, we had Morgan O'Kane play with Bruce Burris's work because it was a very direct connection, both from the same region of the state. But I think in a lot of cases, it's just sort of by nature what has to happen. And I'm usually happy with the way it turns out. Sometimes you have to move things around too, you know.
Oh, like reorganizing the artwork too.
Yeah, like during the Bob Morgan show, which were these big sculptures that were installed on trash cans in the middle of the gallery. We had a sort of electronic bluegrass band that wanted to play that night, so we had to move everything out of the way. And it was sort of crazy, but
do musicians end up coming to you, or do you seek them out, or is it kind of a
little bit of both? I mean, the way it started was an invitation to Morgan, and then of course people came and they suggested this person and that, and now it's become a regular part of our program. We even have a summer concert series where the gallery's booked 7 to 10 nights in a row every summer, and we just do a number of different performances. And Robert Beatty did a performance called Nuns, where N-O-N-E-S, where he performed 5 nights in a row with 5 different collaborators. So each night, it really took on a different life. And that's how the CD feels as well. You know, people, I don't know what people are expecting when they hear 193 sound, but it really is sort of all over the place. I mean, there's traditional music, including John Cohen's recordings from Vico, Kentucky in the early 60s, and the Quilt Makers of G's Bend and Lonnie Holly. But then you have, people like Robert Beatty or Ben Durham, who are doing essentially noise or electronic music. And then you have bluegrass and, I mean, just everything. I mean, in the 25 tracks, I mean, the last track, for example, is an artist we work with named Louis Bickett, Whistling Silent Night. So it's really across the board.
Unusual to the Institute 193 audience to be coming into the white space and seeing these performances in a tight space? Like, what was the what was the arts environment like in Lexington when you started 193, and did people adapt readily to this different type of gallery space, or did they even have any idea of what to expect?
Well, I don't. That's sort of the joke. I mean, you know, people walk by and you can hear them outside, you know, because it's not very far and the door doesn't shut exactly all the way. You'll hear people say, oh, I heard you need a membership to get in there. Or, oh, those things cost $3,000. Can you believe it? Or this, that, you know. So, I mean, Lexington is a place where the idea of contemporary art in a contemporary art space is sort of novel at best. That said, there are a few different people doing interesting things. You know, there's another space called the Land of Tomorrow that does very interesting programming and high-end fabrication, actually, for contemporary artists. And then there's other organizations in town that certainly have their moments, but I think we introduced an entirely new aesthetic and procedure to the city. I mean, we really are taking the sort of Lower East Side gallery aesthetic, you know, small spaces and doing very clean shows and forward-looking shows, I think. But we have a distinctly sort of Kentucky or Southern, you know, based character. And it was also an element of organic growth to the whole thing. You know, it started it with a show that was essentially an installation of a guy's environment, you know, of Louis Bickett's archive. And a lot of people thought that we were a new antique shop that was opening, you know, because we don't have a sign up or anything. And so, and then the next show was Bruce Burris, which was sort of very formally installed. And then the next one was this bulletin board cafe, which we literally turned the space into a cafe. And, it took a while for people to sort of wrap their head around a space having all these identities very quickly in the turnover. And the music as well, you know, introducing that element. Yet another thing, yet another hat to wear. So it's been good, though, and I think people have responded very well to the album. It's only been out for about a month. It's been written about, here and there, and generally in a very positive light.
Good. Now, I know with the album, started off, I think you had the idea that it would end up being vinyl, but along the way, it seems like there were just too many good songs to let go of any to make it fit a vinyl size. So I'd be interested to hear, you know, what the selection process was like, if anything did get left on the cutting room floor in the making of the album.
Well, there were a lot of things. And, you know, at the time we started making the album, you know, months ago, I think there had been maybe 30 or 40 artists that had played at the space. But, of course, coordinating with all of them and getting people to actually send you mastered recordings. And there's just sort of a whole weeding out process based on procedure, really, rather than lack of desire. But, you know, this is a curated sequence, and we really chose things that were emblematic of one aspect or one idea that was inherent to our program. So there were some things that didn't really fit as well, but again, the nature of the album is really eclectic, so we're not searching for a singular sort of identity, which again, Institute 193, really trying to document the modern South. I mean, we're not interested in presenting some kind of stereotype version of what the South is or should be. And we ended up doing a CD, really, more of a practical concern. I mean, vinyl is certainly has its advantages in terms of sound, and you know, people collect them, and a lot of younger people just, quite frankly, like to have them. But there is this point of accessibility, I think, is very important. So we provided it as a download and then as a CD. And, you know, later I think we're going to do some projects that are very specific with maybe 5-7 tracks, and then we'll do vinyl for those.
Was this your first experience producing an album?
Yes, formally. I mean, I've done some, as an artist, I've done some record covers for different artists, and I've been involved in different aspects of the music industry, particularly doing stages. I'm actually doing the backdrop for a stage for a concert on Monday night with Ben Solee and Jim James, and all these Kentucky guys are playing in Louisville, and I'm doing the backdrop. And so, I mean, I always touch on music and touch on aspects of those things, but I never really set out to make an album. Mm-hmm. That's very different.
Yeah. With Institute 193, you've transitioned from being sort of director and founder to editor-in-chief, as your role at Souls Grown Deep has become greater and greater. You know, what sort of future do you see for the space at this point, and where do you see your relationship as it continues to grow?
I don't know. I mean, I think the goal of Institute 193 was always to take things out of the place in which they were created or born. And you know, the exhibitions in a way are less important to me because, quite frankly, very few people see them. I mean, maybe 500 to 1,000 people see any given exhibition we do, but through publications, compact discs, whatever particular product we make, you have the potential to reach thousands and thousands of people, particularly with the internet, websites, social media. So I think increasingly that Institute 193 will focus its efforts on the actual production of publications, records, things of that nature, and ideally become sort of a Southern visual arts version of McSweeney's or a similar company that really produces things that are emblematic of this region but that aren't confined by it either. And I always see my role as being a very significant contributor to 193. I mean, it was never intended to be mine or for me to own it, you know, in any way. That's why it's a nonprofit, and that's why it doesn't have my name. Quite frankly, you know, I could have started a gallery with my name in it, and then that would have been a very different thing. But it was always intended to be something that was collectively owned and board governed and that could grow. And, you know, who knows? Maybe we'll have a space in Atlanta, or maybe in Chattanooga, or maybe somewhere else that makes sense if we have the right partners. But ultimately, I really want to focus on making beautiful, important documents that really demonstrate what it is that we, you know, collectively are capable of as artists, musicians, and writers. We've worked with a lot of writers as well. So
it's interesting that the space is sort of secondary to the idea of the long-term publications and the long-term mm-hmm. impact. It usually seems like it's the other way around for exhibition spaces. Does this come out of, I guess as a nonprofit, there's not so much emphasis on having to, or necessarily pushing the sales of a lot of works. So you guys don't consider yourselves salesmen.
Well, I mean, you know, we sell things or we don't, depending on the show. That's the sort of beauty of being a nonprofit, that the artists can make them available, or if they choose not to, they don't have to. What I have always really valued is this sort of long-term documentation and education and discussion of all these ideas. In a space, you know, any time you do an exhibition, or any kind of project, it has a very short shelf life, even if it lasts 6 months. However long it lasts, still relatively short when compared to a book or something that conceivably could last generations. And I'm much more interested in creating that kind of content than I am in mounting these exhibitions and happenings and things. Although they can be useful also in the promotion of the actual product. And I think very few spaces actually do that and actually take the time. I mean, I know in Atlanta, Chattanooga, Knoxville, I mean, there are very few organizations that are actually creating significant publications. I mean, it's just not something they do. It's logistically complicated, and it costs a fair amount of money. And, you know, if you just put a bunch of things on the wall, that's easier.
Yeah.
You know, I would like to see us grow. And we also do, people don't really know this necessarily, but we do a lot of other exhibitions and projects in other spaces. You know, we collaborate with people, whether it be in Dallas, Atlanta, New York, Paris. We've done a lot of different things. So the publications can go there, and exhibitions and projects can be done in those places. So it's a little, you know, it's less important for me that it be a physical space, and more important that it be something that's growing and changing.
Are there other organizations similar to Institute 193 that you had in mind when you were first devising the concept?
There are a few that I like. I mean, it's sort of a hybrid. White Columns in New York, I think, is a very interesting gallery space, although they do very little or any in the way of publishing. They do artist editions and things. They don't really do books. And, you know, McSweeney's is something I like, but of course it's more literary than visual art. You know, they've done some things with, like, Marcel Zama and others, but it's more of a writer's kind of space. And then there are various music labels and record labels that I think that do a good job, but we're really in this kind of new frontier between an artist-run space, a gallery space, a museum in a city that really doesn't have one, and a publishing house / record label. So, I mean, we're really kind of all over the place, but I don't think in a bad way. I mean, I sort of joke that we're moving forward in all directions at once, which, you know, if you look at our logo, it sort of feels that way. It's a star, you know. But I think that long term, one of those things will sort of consume the others or grow beyond the others for whatever reason, and I think we'll just sort of go with it.
Do you think that the Lexington area is responding well to it? When I was up in Lexington, I met director Chase Martin, and he was telling me about a show that you guys were curating at the hospital and collaborations you had with the Latitude artist community and all of these different projects happening. Was that something that was made possible through Institute, or were those sorts of shows and collaborations happening before?
No, those were initiatives that we set forth. We have a one nail gallery at Latitude Artist Community, which allows Latitude Artist Communities for people with disabilities, and they go in sort of an art studio environment, but also focuses on different aspects of advocacy. A lot of the artists don't have transportation or are not able to come visit the gallery, so our idea was to bring a piece from every show to them and then have the artists come and do some kind of workshop or talk so that they were able to interact with the work in a meaningful way or the hospital, we've done some collaborative exhibitions with other institutions like the Land of Tomorrow Gallery in both Lexington and Louisville. We've done things. And, you know, quite frankly, I mean, everything I try to do, I try to find partners with whom we can collaborate, because it's just always, it's better. I mean, it's better. You have more people and more resources and different audiences that you can introduce to an idea or a subject. And I think we've been served very well by that mentality.
Yeah.
And I think Lexington embraces the gallery. I mean, at first it was sort of a tough sell. Not only was it in the middle of the recession, so I mean, financially it was a tough sell, but you know, there wasn't a space like that. There just was nothing like it. So it wasn't as if you were introducing a new music store or a new record store or a new bookstore or something that they knew. You know, introducing a contemporary art space that's sort of a hybrid publishing house. I mean, people just don't do it.
Now, do you think you benefited from there not being really any gallery spaces of the white box model to begin with?
Sure. I mean, sort of a mixed blessing, you know. I mean, the reason those things don't exist in those places is because it's very difficult to make it. You go to New York and they're, well, I still think it's 293 would be a standout in New York for various reasons, particularly the kinds of art we show. You know, there are other people with similar ideas, many people with similar ideas. So there's that element of competition. That said, you know, when you have a bunch of retail stores, one next to the other, people go shopping and they look at different things. Whereas if you're a single shop in a place where, with no other shops, people either come there as a destination or they don't. You know, they go there, they don't. And if they don't want to go there, don't know why they should go there, aren't particularly interested in what you have, it's really hard to get them in the door. So Lexington has certainly been a mixed blessing. But it's also changing. The 21C Museum Hotel is opening there next year, and the Land of Tomorrow opened about the same time we did. And I think there's a little bit of movement there for these kinds of spaces. So after you get three or four, you know, I think it's going to be a very different landscape.
When I first moved to Atlanta, people were excited about the new stuff that was happening here, but there were the cynics who said Atlanta is cyclical and these rises in organizations have happened before and there will be falls and it'll just keep on going around. Is that true of Lexington? It kind of sounds like this is the first time Lexington has really had sort of a rise in art spaces ever.
You know, I have, you know, for better or worse, I'm too young to really know the answer to the historical aspect of your question. But what I would say is that, you know, life is cyclical. I mean, that's just the way it is. Cities and I mean, everything has a sort of cyclical nature to it. But I think it's a very good time to be there now. I mean, I don't know. I don't know what will happen in another generation or two. I can't really worry about it, I suppose. I mean, I think that right now that there's a lot of movement and people are excited, and I think we should ride that wave until we can't. What I do think is that, you know, resources generally for the arts are not available. They generally have not been available in the past, and I think they will continue to be very competitive in the future, and that's just the way it is. I mean, you know, things like UK basketball or the Kentucky Derby or any of the bourbon-related activities, I mean, those things are always going to have a certain kind of mass popularity or following, and a small visual arts space is always going to have to fight for whatever kind of resources, whether that be in 1960 or 2050. That's okay. That's okay.
And Steam 193 is ready for it?
I think so. I mean, I don't know that we have a choice. You know, go all out or quit.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast. If you'd like to know more about Philip March Jones, head to his website, philipmarchjones.com. That's philipmarchjones.com. If you'd like to know more about Institute 193, head to institute193.org. As always, check out burnaway.org for events, reviews, and articles about art. And check out our website, outthereatlanta.com, for photos and updates. Thanks for listening. Back when I was still in high school, hopping clouds not coming down, melodies were rolling down my windows, the beats were driving me around. Used to be I had a heart so big, there was room for anything I found. Like to think that I'm not full up just yet.
Gone, gone, gone. It gets so.